Well, spent a lot longer, probably because of those readings this morning, coming up to the before arriving at the sermon. And obviously we have a lot of material there before us and we can't possibly address all of it. But let me begin by saying that so far my approach to this kind of legal section of Deuteronomy has been to say that it follows the contours of the Ten Commandments. That's the argument I've tried to sustain over the last couple of months. And basically then we could say that commandments numbers 1 to 4 of the Ten Commandments are all about how an Israelite relates to his God. And likewise, Deuteronomy chapters 12 to 16 are all about how an Israelite relates to his God. Commandments numbers 6 to 10 are all about how an Israelite relates to his neighbour. And in future weeks, we'll see how Deuteronomy chapters 19 to 26 are all about how an Israelite relates to his neighbour. But what about the commandment I've missed out there, the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment, as you know, is about obeying your mother and your father. Well, on the one hand, your mother and your father are not your God, are they? They are your neighbour, so they fit more naturally into commandments 6 to 10. On the other hand, however, I think the fifth commandment really is more about our obedience to authority as a whole, isn't it? It's sort of depicted most fundamentally in our relationship to our mother and father, or our father and mother. But really the commandment is getting at our relationship to authority as a whole. And authority which comes from where then? Well, an authority which stems fundamentally from God. Because God has appointed your parents over you, and God has appointed a variety of other authorities over you, authorities to whom you owe your obedience. So all of that to say that I think the fifth commandment is a kind of transitional commandment. It is about our relationship to society at large, our neighbour, but it's a relationship which begins with our submission to God and the authorities that God has placed over us. And all of that then is to simply say that in the same way, I think that the big passage we've just read out this morning, Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 8, all the way to the end of chapter 18, that material corresponds with the fifth commandment. It's all about the authorities that God has placed over Israel. The judges, the priests, the king, the prophet. It's about the nature of the authority that they possess, and it's about the way in which he wants Israel to relate to those authorities. That's my basic overview. And with that in place, then, I have 3 points for us to mull over this morning. Firstly, Israel's authorities derived from God. Israel's authorities derived from God. If you, as an ancient Israelite, had the audacity to do that which God really hated, and we have that at the beginning of chapter 17 and the end of chapter 16, if you put up an Asherah pole, for instance, or you offered a defective sacrifice, or worse still, you worshipped other gods, the Lord might not strike you down with a bolt of lightning like that. But he had appointed authorities to deal with you. Authorities which had the God-given responsibility to assess the evidence, and if the evidence was against you, then to bring you out to the city gates, and there in verse 5 of chapter 17, to put you to death. If you were a priest or you were a local judge and you were having a hard time assessing one of these cases, and so what you did then is you took the matter to Jerusalem, and this is the kind of situation we have in chapter 17, and you took that case then to those specially trained priests and judges, and those people in Jerusalem then applied their special expertise and told you what you should do, you weren't free to ignore those people. You weren't free to come to your own decision. Verse 12. the man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judge, that man shall die. Because if you didn't obey, you weren't just despising another judge, you were despising God's judge. You were despising God's own authority expressed through that judge. The authorities in Israel demanded your respect. They had the power to carry out God's penalty upon you. And actually respecting the authorities meant more than just keeping the law. It also meant sacrifices. Literal sacrifices in this case. Chapter 18 begins by telling us that the priests are dependent really on the support of the people. Unlike everybody else in Israel, that the Levite doesn't have an inheritance in the land itself. His inheritance is what is given to him through the sacrifices of others. The grain, the wine, the oil, the wool, and so forth. And so you see then that the nation just couldn't function without the free giving of the people towards their authorities. It depended on their submission and their embracing and their sacrificial giving to those authorities that God had instituted over them. That's basically my first point. The authorities had an authority that they derived from God. Now, I've said it several times, I think, in the last year, but the passage encourages me to make the same point again. Submission for us Christians shouldn't be a dirty word. Even today, now we don't live in ancient Israel, but neither did the first Christians who lived in Rome. They didn't live in ancient Israel. They lived in Rome of all places. And yet that didn't prevent the Apostle Paul from saying to them, let every person, those of you in Rome, be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. And I want to say to you then this morning, let every person in this church be subject to the authorities God has placed over them. And I mean that with respect to the state, but not just with respect to the state. I mean with respect to all of those authorities God has appointed within your lives, authorities within the family, authorities within the church, authorities within your workplace. Submission should not be a dirty word. Remember what the Apostle Paul says to the church in Ephesus, Ephesians chapter 6. This is what he says. Bond servants. He's speaking to those who are servants, who are slaves, who are under the master, who serve others as masters. Obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. That's striking. That's countercultural. Not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bond servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is bond servant or free. Let me put the matter like this. If you, in your workplace, have a boss who really gets on your wick and you really struggle with him, or if you have a father or a mother who brings you to the point of exasperation sometimes and you are just so frustrated with them, and maybe rightly so, if you have a teacher at school who just seems to have it in for you, who just doesn't like you, who just enjoys treating you differently to the other kids in the class. The best advice I can give you this morning, and this is scriptural advice, is to do this, is to show that person far more respect than they should ever expect to receive from you. indeed, to serve them as if you were serving the Lord. I don't think we've properly digested that teaching. That is a radical perspective that Paul gives us. And in a society which is instinctively anti-authoritarian, we struggle with that kind of thing, don't we? But that's what the apostle tells us. And I think that in doing that, the impact of your Christian witness will be far brighter if you respect the authorities God has placed over you. Now, I'm not saying you flatter that other person. I'm not saying you grovel under them. You hold to your biblical principles at all times. You stand your ground, don't you, when you need to. You don't allow them to push you into doing things which are wrong. And you speak out when you need to. And sometimes the Lord does require us to speak out boldly against those authorities which are over us. And all of that calls for a lot of wisdom then. But in that, we still respect their authority. We have to. That's what we're told to do. And again, I think when people see you doing that, and when the authorities see you doing that, they don't look at you and think, look at that pushover, look at that weak person. I think probably they think that person is strong. That person is self-controlled. That person has principles. Isn't that what you think when you see Jesus standing there in the Sanhedrin, and no, the Sanhedrin is throwing those false accusations upon him, and he's not sort of trying to counter every single one of them, and he's holding his tongue, and he's not being nasty back at them. You know, he's a man of great eloquence. He could respond in whatever way he liked to those false accusations, but he just stands there. And you have Pilate, don't you, standing right there up at his face almost, and Caiaphas, and they're taunting him, and they're trying to get him to snap back. And Jesus tells Pilate, well, he acknowledges it. He has an authority which God has given him. And he does question Pilate. He doesn't go along with everything Pilate says. But nevertheless, he stands there calmly. And we read that man in the scriptures, and we have to say, this man is strong. This man is strong. So that's my first point then. Aspire to that kind of strong submission which the Lord requires for us and which the Lord required of Israelites. Not to be instinctively anti-authoritarian, but to be instinctively submissive. Israel's authorities derived from God. Secondly, Israel's authorities were under God. Israel's authorities were under God. Now, we've already said that the judge, the local judge, is accountable to the higher judge in Jerusalem, the place the Lord will choose. Let's take this sort of up the chain of command, though. Let's take this to the very top of the chain. Let's take this to the highest authority in the land of Israel. What about the king? Who ultimately is the king of Israel accountable to, according to Deuteronomy 17? Well, in many ancient cultures, the answer to that question was very simple. No one. The king was not accountable to anyone in many ancient nations. So long as he keeps his people happy and keeps his people under control, he gets to do precisely as he likes. In many of the ancient nations, he was a god in himself. He received worship from his subjects. Not in Israel. Not in Israel. It was entirely different. In Israel, the king might get his authority from God, but that does not make him a god himself. No, ultimately, it means that he is under God just as much as any of his subjects. And that means he is under the law of God just as much as any of his subjects. And that's what we see here in chapter 17, verse 18. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, that's the law of Deuteronomy, approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life. that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all his words of this law and these statutes and doing them. You get the sense in which the king of Israel is expected to be entirely different from all of the other ancient nations and the kings of the nations. They are consciously, deliberately, fearfully under God. They of all people have been tasked with taking this very book of Deuteronomy and carefully writing out its every word, creating for themselves a kind of personalized copy of this book, and then reading it. They see it there in their own handwriting for them to reflect upon and to meditate upon, and indeed for them to fear. That's the word which is used. That's significant, isn't it? That is countercultural of anything. The king, verse 19, has to learn to fear. Verse 20. And that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So if you want to have a prosperous kingdom, according to Deuteronomy, and you want to have a long and happy and healthy reign, you need to be the kind of king who trembles at the thought of breaking God's law, because you know your place and you are under God. Now, the question might arise, mightn't it? What exactly does the king have to fear? He's the king, isn't he? The commoner has to fear the judge or the priest, and the judge has to fear the higher judge in Jerusalem. But what about the king? Who does the king fear? Are we now in the territory of being struck by lightning? Well, almost we are sort of in that territory now, aren't we? Because the last part of chapter 18 introduces us to another office of authority in Israel. And it's an office then which is very different to the people that we've looked at so far. It's here that we meet the prophet. And the prophet is a different kind of authority in that he is not appointed by the people like a judge or a king will be. And he's not born into his position like a Levite might be. No, the man is called by God. So this is a man who, irrespective of his social status, has been raised up by the Lord in the words of the passage. And irrespective of other people's social status, when this man speaks, they must listen. Now, Moses, here in this bit of the passage, reminds us there in verse 16 of the day when the people of Israel couldn't bear to hear the voice of God, and they need a mediator. They need Moses himself to spend time there in the burning presence of God and to listen to the booming words of God, because they can't possibly tolerate it, and then to pass on the words of that God to them. That's what they ask for, and the Lord approves of that request. But the Lord here promises that he will continue to raise up men like that, men who can do that. Men who do stand in the divine presence and receive the words of God, then pass that word on to the people. And that's precisely what the prophets did, isn't it? Men like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. These are all men who came fresh out of the divine presence. These are men who had stood there in the divine council, and they had heard divine words speaking in their ears, and indeed, in the words of verse 18 here, being placed in their mouths. It's interesting there, verse 18. I will raise up a prophet for them from among their brothers, like you, and I will place my words in his mouth, and he will speak to them all that I command him. The wording there is exactly mirrored in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 7. All that I command you, you shall speak, the Lord says to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 9. I have placed my words in your mouth. So instantly then, this person, whether it be Jeremiah or any of the other prophets, they instantly have more authority than even the greatest of kings. You know, most days of the week, a man like Nathan is the subject of a man like David, King David. But when King David sins against Bathsheba, and God takes Nathan and places his words in Nathan's mouth, Nathan has no choice. He now occupies a position of authority even over David in this situation. And so he must condemn even his king in the strongest possible terms. And King David has no choice but to submit to the prophet Nathan. It's interesting there, at the very end of our passage, it says, the very end there, verse 22, it basically says that you don't need to be afraid of a false prophet if he speaks presumptuously. If it doesn't come to pass, you don't need to be afraid of him. But the implication is, isn't it? The implication is that when it comes to the true prophet, you really should be afraid of him. Because that man stands before you as a true representative of the heavenly council. And time again, then, it was the role of God's prophet to confront even the scariest of kings, kings like Ahab, and to tell those kings in no uncertain terms that if you keep on breaking God's law, there will be fearful consequences. I guess my point of application here this morning is simply to say that it doesn't matter who you are in this life. The bottom line is that you occupy your position under God. All the prime ministers, all the presidents, all the heads of state, all the kings and queens. The Bible says that they are God's stewards, doesn't it? But as God's stewards, they are ultimately accountable to God. A day is coming when they will be judged by God. Now, I quoted Ephesians 6 earlier on with respect to the bondservants, the slaves. But remember, in that chapter, Paul also tells us how the masters of those bondservants should act in their position. And what does he say to them? He says this: masters, do the same to them and stop your threatening, he says, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. The master in heaven doesn't look at the master of the bondservant and think, well, because he's in that position of higher authority, I'll treat him more favourably than the grovelling servant underneath him. No, he treats both fairly. Both are under God. And it's the same for all of us this morning. It may be that some of you are in a role of authority. You're not presidents and heads of state, okay, but you're in roles of authority and responsibility that the Lord has placed you in. You might be someone else's boss. You might be someone else's employer, someone's teacher in the classroom. You might be someone's father or someone's mother. You might be someone's grandfather or grandmother. It might be that within your own sphere, you have an authority of one kind or another. You command people's respect. Well, this is just a gentle reminder for you this morning that God remains at the top of that chain. And whoever you are, whether you think of yourself as a slave or you think of yourself as a master, you carry out your responsibility under the gaze of God, whoever you are. In your position in the workplace or in the family or in the church or wherever we're talking about here, you should never be thinking along these lines. You should never be thinking, how much exactly can I get away with here? How much can I do just to keep that person happy? How much can I get away with that is expedient? How can I do the bare minimum? That should not be the way you're treating your position. You should be thinking to yourself, no, I'm performing this role under God. He sees every decision I make in this position. and I fear him. So Israel's authorities then, they derive from God, but they were always under God. And that is something we need to take very seriously indeed. Thirdly, and finally, Israel's authorities were to reflect God. Israel's authorities were to reflect God. I suppose we could say that until the book of Deuteronomy, Moses has occupied that position of supreme authority under God, of course, but supreme authority in Israel. So at a human level, who is the supreme judge in Israel right now? Well, it's Moses, isn't it? Who is the supreme priest in Israel? I suppose you could make a good case that it's Moses, really, not Aaron. Who is the supreme prophet in Israel? Well, it's Moses. Our chapter sort of describes Moses as a kind of archetypal prophet. So Moses is the one then who represents God's authority in Israel more than anyone else. But for that reason, it was so important that Moses reflected the character of God more than anyone else. Moses had to be a godly man. He had to be just. He had to be fair. He had to be faithful. He had to be true. He had to be kind. He had to be gracious. He had to be the humblest man in all the earth, as we read in the book of Numbers. And for much of his life then, Moses does a good job of that by human standards. But Moses is now going to die, isn't he? And that raises a question. Who will take his place? Who is now going to stand in that position of supreme authority in Israel? And the answer to that question is really that, for now, no one is going to be able to sufficiently hold together all of Moses' different responsibilities. No, rather, his responsibilities for now are going to be shared throughout the community. So you're going to have judges over here, and you're going to have priests over here, and those two roles obviously in Deuteronomy overlap. But then you're going to have kings over here, a sort of chief secular power, if you want to put it like that. But then you're going to have prophets over here. So all of these roles are kind of spread out. And yes, we do occasionally get points where they overlap, but no one is in Israel is sufficiently kind of holding all of those roles together like Moses did. But there are going to be these different men then, and they're going to represent their God in all of their different ways, and they're going to reflect God's character. So for one thing, the authority that they possess must reflect God's justice and God's righteousness. I mean, this is how the passage begins, isn't it? End of chapter 17. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality or accept a bribe. A bribe blinds the heart of the wise and subverts the course of the righteous. Verse 20, justice and only justice you shall follow. So these are the principles which are given primary position in our passage, aren't they? Justice and only justice. And you see those principles worked out then, don't you? So practically speaking then, it means that the penalty which is given to the person who defies God is severe, but it's also fair and accurate. You know, people are put to death only when there's been a diligent inquiry. Verse 4, only when it's true and certain that an abomination has been done in Israel. It has to meet these criteria. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness alone. That wouldn't be fair. That wouldn't be an accurate way of dealing with it. And if you're going to be the kind of person who makes an accusation against someone, you also have to be the kind of person who's prepared to carry that out. You're the one who's going to cast the first stone. So you can see all of these things then, they're working together to give us a system which it's not simply pragmatic. It's not just do what works. It's not utilitarian. It's not just all about harm reduction. No, it's a system which operates according to the very highest of principles. Justice, righteousness. These are the things which characterize the law. Likewise, Israelite authority had to reflect God's truth and his faithfulness. So you have that section there at the end of chapter 18, or verses 9 to 14, and they tell us about the other ways of accessing truth in the world, and you have people out there who are receiving counsel from omens and mediums or whatever, the reading the entrails of sheep, or the watching sort of the oil spiral round in the goblet, or dealing with an apparition or something like that. And the prophet of God then, he stands against all of that, and he cuts through all of that fog, and he pronounces concrete, reliable, faithful words of truth. He represents God in all of his truth. And this is the God then who Deuteronomy 32 is going to describe as the rock, whose work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. This is the God who the authorities are reflecting. And then finally, consider the kings. You know, what principle does the king embody? Well, chapter 17, verses 16 to 17. He's not to acquire many horses for himself, or many wives for himself, or much silver and gold for himself. He's not to turn people's hearts to Egypt. And he's not to allow his heart to be lifted up above his brothers, verse 20. So this is a man who doesn't encourage any kind of personality cult. This is a man who doesn't believe he is entitled to special treatment. This is a man who remains humble and self-effacing, we could even say. And this is the kind of king who even treats the very lowest of his subjects as his brother. And again, this is the divine character, isn't it? This is what we have in the God of the Scriptures. A God who, although he is above all things, and although all things are from him and through him and to him, nevertheless, we have a God who doesn't tyrannize his creation. We don't have a God who exploits his creation. We don't have a God who abuses his people. We have a God who stoops down to his creation and counts the very smallest of his subjects as his friends and his brothers. That's in the heart of our God. Now, as I'm drawing to a close now, but let me just say this. As good as Moses might have been, for the first 39 books of the Bible, for the Old Testament, we never meet a man who is able to hold all of these roles together. We never meet a man who is able to hold all of these roles together while reflecting the divine character perfectly. Now, Moses comes close, but eventually Moses cracks, doesn't he? He has that moment of anger, and that disqualifies him. David comes close. He acts as a king. He acts as a prophet. Arguably, he acts as a priest. But then David cracks under sexual pressure, doesn't he? And David is disqualified. And then there's Solomon. And for a time, you're reading 1 Kings chapter 10, and you know, it seems like, for a moment, it seems like this could be him. This could be the promised son of David, the man who holds all of these roles together and reflects the character of his God perfectly. And you're reading there 1 Kings chapter 10, and thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his mind. And it seems so exuberantly positive, doesn't it? And then suddenly, the words just flow seamlessly into this statement. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt. That's exactly what Deuteronomy warns us about. And it goes on. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. And on the one hand, you're thinking, that's good, isn't it? But no, the book of Deuteronomy says that the king shouldn't multiply silver or gold for himself. And it goes on. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Egypt. He's turning their hearts to Egypt. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, Hittite women. He had 700 wives who were princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. That is exactly what Deuteronomy warns us about. Solomon is disqualified. Now, you know what I'm going to say, but I don't think my sermon would be complete without saying it. 2,000 years ago, a man finally steps onto the stage of history who is able to carry all of the authority of God while flawlessly reflecting all the character of God. And he never, ever, ever cracks. And his name is Jesus Christ. God himself made man. All of us are under God. I think really we could say all of us are under Jesus Christ, the God-man, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the one who gathers up the role of prophet and priest and king and judge and brings those roles into their most powerful and most godly expression. And he, more than any other authority then, is just and is righteous and is faithful and is true. And that is a good thing. You know, it should bring you some comfort to know that the little man with the mustache doesn't escape the judgment of Jesus Christ when he shoots himself in the head back in the 1940s. The blood of 6 million Jews cries out against him. But then again, judgment doesn't stop with Adolf Hitler, does it? Because on the day of judgment, Jesus Christ will judge this whole world like it's never been judged before. A day is coming when every fact will be considered. Every qualification will be respected. Every moment will be scrutinized. No stone will be left unturned. And then a fair penalty will be placed upon us. And if we're honest with ourselves, that should make some of us feel uncomfortable. Especially uncomfortable if our only relationship with this man is with him as judge. Let me just warn you this morning, if you haven't heard this before or you haven't properly acknowledged this fact. If you refuse this man's kingship and reign to the very bitter end, and you are determined not to submit to his rule, and you will make him your enemy, well, he will be your enemy. And that is not what you want. Which is why I urge you then to make peace with this king. Kiss the son, lest he be angry, as Psalm 2 says. And find him first then to be your merciful brother before you have to meet him as the inflexible judge. And I end then this morning by saying you can meet him as your merciful brother. You know, the Lord Jesus Christ, he wants to be your king. He wants your submission. But he is also a king like no one else. And to those who properly realise this, submission to him should be the happiest and most natural and indeed most liberating thing a human being can experience. He wants to be your brother king. He wants to be your shepherd king. He rules the nations with an iron rod. He rules his sheep with a gentle shepherd's staff. And he comes then 2,000 years ago, and he comes not to feast with Herod. He comes to eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners. He comes not to rub shoulders with the high and mighty. He comes to touch lepers of all people. He comes not like the rulers of the Gentiles who lord it over each other. He comes in the first instance not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. In Jesus Christ, the unapproachable God becomes the most approachable man in the whole world, in the whole universe. Receive him as your brother. Receive him as your friend. And in the same moment, bow down before him as your king and submit to him. And place yourself under him. And in doing that, then, you will find a life and a salvation which you will not find anywhere else. Amen.